Reinhardt, and welcome to the Minor Conversations podcast, where I'll offer a glimpse behind the game day experience in the Eastern League with candid discussions and interesting stories both on and off the field. If you like what you hear, do me a favor and spread the word on iTunes, where you can subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. If you have any ideas for topics or people you want to hear from, get in touch with me on Twitter at Mayflies, or the podcast has a Twitter account too at MinorConsPod. That would be MinorConsPod. Now, on to the show. Legendary sports writer Dick Schaap once said, "I wanted to be a sports writer because I love sports, and I could not hit the curveball, the jump shot, or the opposing ball carrier." My guest for this episode of the podcast can sympathize with Schaap's sentiment. Tom Riesenweber always wanted a career in sports. He just never imagined it would be as a sports writer. Yet here he is covering all manner of high school, college, and professional sports for the Erie Times News, his hometown newspaper. Tom is one of the best and most dedicated beat writers in the Eastern League, covering all things Seawolves. We talked about Tom's unusual journey to sports writer, a typical day in his life covering the Seawolves, and the direction of the team both on and off the field. So sit back and enjoy episode 2 of the Minor Conversations podcast with my guest, Tom Riesenweber. Thanks for joining me, Tom. You weren't one of those kids who dreamed of becoming a sports writer from an early age. You ended up going to St. Bonaventure and graduated with a business degree. What were your plans with that?
Yeah, it's interesting because I always wanted to be kind of like in sports business at some point. I'm not really sure what kind of role, whether that was sales or marketing or just kind of working with some kind of sports team. So I went for business to the number 2 journalism school in the country and didn't take any journalism classes. So basically, when I graduated in 2006, I was looking for jobs where, you know, up in Erie, we're in the basically the middle of a triangle between Cleveland, Pittsburgh, and Buffalo. So I was sending out resumes and getting interviews with different organizations and trying to find something to get started. And when I was in high school, I did the stats for all of our teams for football, basketball, and baseball through the book for baseball. So I knew the sports writers pretty well just from my experience then. So I called up one I knew pretty well and said, you know, it was August. I hadn't found anything yet. I said, "Hey, just while I'm job searching, do you have any kind of job where I can tag along and do stats for you or something like that?" And he got me on as a stringer, which basically we take box scores and phone calls over the phone from high school games and do different briefs. And that started in August of 2006. And it kind of molded into where I started covering games for the newspaper. I covered games, did more feature stories, now and then when I need somebody, and when the one writer that I contacted, he actually resigned in 2008 to spend more time with his wife, and they gave me his job. So they basically, while I was job searching, I found a different career, and it's worked out pretty well.
How important was it for you, coming to the job in a non-traditional fashion, to have editors and writers help you along in the process, take you under their wing, kind of teach you how to do the job day to day?
Oh yeah, without a doubt. You know, our assistant sports editor, Jeff Carrick, who's now the sports editor, really worked with me a lot on my writing. You know, obviously, I knew sports pretty well because I've always been a huge sports fan. No matter what's on TV, I'll watch it. It was just a matter of writing and figuring out how to do different things and how to organize your thoughts and kind of get the important stuff up there on top of stories, things like that. There's, you know, still to this day, we still talk about things and work on things, and he's now our main sports editor. So really, he and the other writers, some have gone to different jobs, some are still with us. That really helped me out. It's really, it's all about just keep continuing to learn and work hard and try to keep improving and, you know, ask questions. You know, the one thing that I was reading the one day that one of the writers gave me was an interview with Buster Olney back when he was a beat writer with the Yankees before he became famous. And his advice was to always write down everything you hear from people, every source, no matter how insignificant it could seem. Write it down. You're always learning. Always ask questions. Always try to read your own copy and see what you can do better. So just, you know, reading that was pretty important. And just talking to the writers and editors and different things like that, you always try to learn new things, and it's been great to kind of grow in the whole process.
What's the size of the sports department in general at the Erie Times News?
Well, it's kind of gone downhill. Every time someone leaves, we're not really getting anyone replaced when they leave. You know, it's funny, when I started, I believe there were 7 or 8 full-time, and I was an intern for a month and a part-time writer for a couple of years. And we're down just 3 of us now. We've had guys leave for other jobs. Dwayne Rankin's down in Alabama covering Alabama football now. We had 2 guys retire. One guy resigned to move to Florida to get a teaching. He's leaving the industry. So we're down just 3 of us now. So the whole concept of beats has really become interesting because we have, I'm on the Erie Seawolves. We have a guy who is our OHO hockey team, the Erie Otters. And beyond that, it's kind of just pitch in where you can with high school and college and the Erie Bayhawks, who's our G League team. We may not have them 2 years anyway, but it's kind of just mix and match now. We're going to be covering stuff we're not usually covering, so the whole beat thing is kind of going away in our paper.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. I know besides the Seawolves, you cover a wide variety of other sports. At this point, is there anything you don't cover?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I don't really cover is the Erie Otters, our OHL team, but ironically, a couple years ago, I had to fill in for a playoff game when our writer was out of town. That was the only time I ever got to see Connor McDavid play in Erie, which is pretty cool. But, pretty much everything at this point. Yesterday, I was going to the Bayhawks practice to do a preview, but their playoff game's been postponed until Saturday because of a death in the league of a player. So it's one of those things where, there's been times in the fall where I've covered college volleyball, high school soccer, football, and college football all the same week. It's just kind of a mix and match thing now and just try to survive and get everything covered.
So back to the Seawolves coverage. When did you actually start covering the team for the paper?
This will be, this will be my 6th year. So 5 years ago, it was the last year of Chris Krohn managing. Then I had a 4-year stretch of Lance Parrish, which was a lot of fun. But he has moved on to West Michigan now. So going into the 6th year, we'll have a new manager, Andrew Graham, who's a former Erie Seawolf player. So should be a lot of fun. But, yeah, this is already 6 years. It's crazy how it all happened because we had a beat writer for about probably 5 years on the Seawolves back in the 2000s. And he was asked to work the cops beat for 2 weeks while one of our writers was on maternity leave. Well, she never came back. And he never came back to sports. That was another reason we lost another writer. So we had another writer cover the Seawolves for 3 years after that, and then they switched to me 5 years ago. So this is crazy. 9 years ago, we had a full-time beat writer change the cops, and all of a sudden, I'm in my 6th year now.
Can you go into a little bit of detail as far as your day goes, if, say, there's a 7:05 Seawolves game?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because of what we have to do so much. So in the spring, it's kind of different than in the summertime. So let's say, for example, in the spring, I'll spend 2-3 hours in the morning updating our high school website and looking around for any kind of minor league or major league news going on Twitter or any of the major networks. I always have MLB Network posts going 24 hours a day on my TV. But it's just interesting spending the morning looking at all different things. I usually go to the office right around noon, just check in with my editor, see what's going on, and I'll spend probably an hour or two there. But I'm usually at the ballpark by 3 o'clock most days. I'll go to the clubhouse, maybe talk to some of the guys, see how things are going, and see if I get a lineup, a couple of lineups early on. Sometimes those are pretty late coming in, which is kind of frustrating. But I'll usually try to get to the ballpark probably about 3 o'clock, get things settled in. Talk to the guys, maybe put some notes up on the website, and just kind of watch BP. I love watching batting practice, just see how the guys are swinging that day. You never know when you can pick up something small, just watching in BP. There's been times where I've seen guys just crush the ball. I was like, oh, this could be a big day, and they end up having a 3-hit day or something like that. So it's also interesting to get there early because you never know what you're going to see. Last year, we saw guys that are prospects in the outfield, taking some infield instructors in town. That's the other thing that's always interesting is to see which instructors from the Tigers are going to be here, just working on things with guys. There was this one time where the night before, the Seawolves had four errors in the infield. And so I got to the ballpark at 3 the next day. And before BP, they were doing just simple infield drills. And I asked Lance Parrish about that. He said, well, sometimes you got to go back to the basics to get these guys going again. So, yeah, it's always kind of interesting to see what could happen before BP. More often than not, it's nothing really going on. But, you know, just want to get to the ballpark, get things settled in, and get set up for the night. And usually I'll spend most of the game in the press box. Sometimes I'll head down to the field just to see some different angles of the game, some pitching. If there's a big prospect, I want to go behind the plate, see what they're doing. Sometimes we have guys in town from other teams I want to take a photo of and see how they're doing. So it's always crazy when we get kind of some kind of rehab from the other team. You're doing everything, its own rehabs. But when other rehabs are in town, I'll usually go down to the bullpen and watch them warm up and do some kind of video. So usually that's going on during the game. And deadlines can be a little crazy for us. During the week, usually if I can get my story in by 10:30 at the latest, that usually works, which is trouble for these long games that we've been having in Erie the last couple of years. We have really not made short games at all. And Saturdays are almost throwing out the window. It's a 7-5 start. You gotta have everything done by 9:30. That usually doesn't happen. Usually I can get maybe a brief in or something like that. But deadlines are brutal. It's kind of interesting to see how those will be affected by this new rule in the minors with the runner starting on second base and the extra innings. Maybe that'll end games quicker. I don't know if it will. I think it may even extend games because I think teams are going to keep scoring. But we'll see how it works out with that. But, you know, it's interesting, just the deadlines. At some point, do you root for extra innings because the game's taking so long that you may not have a chance? Or, you know, there's times where I've turned in stories without any quotes because there's no time to get to the clubhouse. So it really is kind of fluid based on how the game's going.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you are writing as the game goes on just in case you can't get to the clubhouse before your deadline.
Yeah, I don't really like when it happens because, you know, people want to see reactions from different guys and the manager, and, you know, you want to talk about a certain play that happened. But sometimes I'll go down after and do like an online update of my story, but it won't be in the paper. So I don't really enjoy when that happens, but it's tough because it's almost like you got to have your story halfway done when the games end, no matter what happens in the late innings. And that's when it all blows up too. If it's like a 2-0 shutout and, you know, Erie rallies for a 3-run ninth or something like that, then you got to throw out the entire story basically and start over. So it's always interesting on the deadline.
In the course of a week-long homestand, how many stories are you responsible for, whether it be print or on website?
Well, you know, it's pretty much up to me. If I find something or if I find a sidebar, I'll do that. Usually it's just the game story. And we always do kind of a preview capsule going into every series, highlighting the it's interesting. I always highlight the prospects coming to town, not really the Erie prospects, because people know about them. So I always try to highlight who's coming to town. But, you know, it always comes down to, you know, the one thing I hate hearing from my editor is space. Do we have space for this? And I've tried to convince them to do more of, you know, if we don't have space for a sidebar, can I still write it and put it online? And hopefully people will read it. So it's one of those things where sometimes I'm told don't do it because there's no space. But, you know, every now and then there's some kind of sidebar. Now and then some Tigers brass will show up and give an award to a player, or the Seawolves will present a check to something, or some kind of charity thing, or there's always something going on, usually at least once a homestand. So try to do sidebars when I can, but usually it's just up to me. If I can find features, I'll do extra features on that, usually for Sundays. But usually it's just the game stories and whatever else I can find basically during the week.
And you cover road games? I mean, I know the way the newspaper industry has gone, that's kind of gone out the door at the minor league level, but I didn't know if you followed along or did game stories.
Yeah, usually we normally don't go, which I really hate because I love going to other ballparks. I think there's a lot of really nice ballparks in the Eastern League, but I'll usually watch the road games through MILB TV or listen to it if there's no feed available. And I'll end up doing a couple graphs for a brief or a paper on the road games. But there are times where I can find an excuse to go on the road. You know, Akron is only about an hour and 45 minutes away, and they're Cleveland affiliate. So if they have some big prospect that's doing well, and we have a lot of Indians fans here, they'll maybe let me go to that. And I'm still trying to negotiate my way into the opening week at Reading and Bowie. I just think that no matter what, you should always cover the opener on the road or home. So we'll see what happens with there. But I've been to different areas. My mom lives in Washington, D.C., so I've been able to go to some trips when the Seals go to Bowie and just stay with her. Obviously, I've been to Harrisburg for the only time they made the playoffs in my tenure was 2013, my first year. Been to Altoona for, you know, Pirates, because there are a lot of Pirate fans in the area, and Akron. So I've been to most of the Western Division. I'm still trying to get to more of some of the Eastern Division teams, but usually they don't let us, they don't want to pay for the road trips. You know, obviously we're trying to scrape by with nickels and dimes right now, so it's usually not approved to go on the road.
What's the biggest difference you see on the beat between now and when you started?
I would say just for myself is just be a little more confident. You know, when that first year, it was, I had been covering, I've been to MLB games and Division I basketball and football, and I've been to a lot of big games, but it's just seeing these guys every day, you kind of need to get comfortable with them a little bit. That first year, it was tough because there were so many things going on. The Seals were actually really good, and so we had brass in town all the time from Detroit. We had a lot of instructors in there, and we had a lot of guys moving up and down. I mean, that was the year we had, like, Hernan Perez, Tyler Collins, Eugenio Suarez, Daniel Fields. So there was a lot going on. James McCann was on that team. But it was just kind of surviving that first year and getting used to what I'm doing every day. I mean, there'd be games where our days I'd show up late and miss something, and, you know, I had to learn the lesson the hard way to try to put as much time as you can into this team. So I think just kind of getting a routine and growing as a beat writer is, it's been big over the last 5 years doing this. And I think it's interesting too, the big part really that I've noticed in the last 5 years is the first year they're really good, they won a lot, so going to that clubhouse is pretty easy. But after that, the team was terrible for a couple of years there, so you have to really learn how to deal with a team that's losing a lot and they don't really want to talk about it. So you have to find ways to get interviews and talk to the manager. And I mean, there's times, I think 2 or 3 years ago, where the Seawolves would lose 9 of 10 and they were 20 games out, and I'd walk into the clubhouse and Lance Parrish and I would look at each other and go, well, what are we even talking about at this point? So I think it's just kind of learning different ways to handle a season. You know, 140 games, it's tough because obviously you're not going to win a ton of those games. So you have to deal with losses, deal with walk-off losses, walk-off wins. It's just a lot of different things you have to learn as you cover the team.
Yeah, I've been in that situation as well, and it's just not fun going into that kind of a clubhouse. You have to find how you can do stories without upsetting half the clubhouse and making it impossible for you to do your job, yet still be a reporter.
Exactly, and especially when if a pitcher's getting shelled, do you want to talk to him about it? If it's a prospect, obviously people want to know why he's getting shelled. Maybe you'll have an idea. Some of these guys are good with that. Some of them, sometimes you find the guys who will talk no matter what. Like, for example, Dean Green and Wade Gaynor. I mean, the Seawolves could lose 25-0, and they could strike out 6 times, and they would be talking to me about the game and what they need to better. So there's guys like that. And I noticed, too, that the former Major League guys are always great. We had three start out with a team last year, and every time I talked to one of them, it was just a great interview. They knew exactly what they're talking about. So that's the thing you got to keep in mind is these guys are still developing how to do interviews as well. They're still young guys. So try to keep that in mind when I go into the clubhouse that these guys may be in college. You know, not a lot of papers cover college baseball that strongly. So these guys maybe aren't used to getting interviewed that much. So they're kind of learning as well as I am.
So you brought it up earlier, but the minor league rehab assignments you get, or should I say you don't get, has been a particular thorn in your side over the years. I know at some point, a couple years ago, it had been since 2009, since a Detroit Tiger had rehabbed with you guys in Erie. And I wondered if that had changed and why you thought that was the case.
Yeah, it's a shame because the people here really love seeing major league players. And anytime there's a rehab here from another team, the place almost sells out. Especially when, you know, we've had probably 4 or 5 Pirates in the last 3 years come through here and pitch or start, and the place has been sold out. And, you know, it's one of the things where we were on a streak of, I think, almost 10 years without one. Last year, they actually sent Daniel Norris to make one start here. And, you know, the players loved it. He not only did he stay, he only pitched four or five innings. He stayed instead of leaving, and he bought everyone in the clubhouse, like Outback Steakhouse. So the Major League guys can make a huge impact when they come down here and see these guys. Even if it's just for one day, one game, one series. And I don't think the Tigers realize that. And I think the big issue that we face here in Erie is the doctors for the Tigers are in Lakeland, which is where their spring training is, and their single A team. And Toledo is only an hour away driving. So basically, for a rehab to come to Erie, Toledo's got to be on the road somewhere ridiculous. Lakeland's got to be on the road somewhere ridiculous. And Erie's got to be home. And sometimes that is lined up, and they've still not sent someone here. I think what really got me going a couple years ago and got most of the fans going was when Victor Martinez was rehabbing. And then he's played for the Indians, so it's a huge fan base for him in the Erie. Toledo was in North Carolina in Durham, and they sent him down there. They flew him from Detroit to there instead of flying to Erie, which is, there's flights in out of Erie to Detroit every day. Four times a day. It's about a 45-minute flight. So all you had to do is fly 45 minutes to Erie to play that night or even that series. And I don't know if it's the facilities or there's not enough, five-star hotels in Erie or what it is, but they just don't send players here that have a perfect opportunity to rehab here. You know, I think the town loves it. The franchise loves it. Ticket sales always go up. I just don't know what it is. I know Dave Dombrowski hated sending players here when he was with the Tigers. I think the Seawolves really made those concerns public they made them clear to Detroit about that. And, Al Avila taking over, sent Daniel Norris here last year. So hopefully there's a trend where they'll send more players here. But I just think it's just a terrible combination of the team doctors are not here and the AAA team is so close that it really takes the perfect situation for a rehab to come here.
Fernando Dwyer bought the team back in 2015. So I just wanted to get your take on if you like the direction that the organization is taking and what kind of changes he's made since buying the team.
Yeah, I think he's lived up to wanting to be here more and be a presence. Before he bought the team, there was a company that had six teams, and they were never here. They're located in Vegas. You never felt like ownership was in Erie and care about the team. And now that Fernando has taken over, he's been here. He's talked to fans. He's tried to figure out what works and what doesn't. I think probably the biggest move in franchise history was getting naming rights to the field. For 20 years, it was Geriot Park, and he was one of the founders of this team and donated all kinds of money to get the field built back in 1995. And to get permission from the family and from Erie to change the name was huge. That's never been even tried before. And so, obviously it's UPMC Park now. I think that lease is for a couple of years, and we'll see what happens after that. But I think that was big because it puts money into the team, into the field, into the stadium. And, I think we're going to start seeing some of that come through these next few years here. His first thing to address was upgrading equipment and getting for the concessions. Obviously, fans are coming first, and I think he wants to do more things, maybe a new scoreboard, video board kind of thing. They want to get a new system in there. So I think we're going to start seeing more improvements these next few years here. But really would help, which they're still trying to get it. A couple years ago, they applied for a grant from the state for, I think, $11 million to kind of rebuild things around here. And still waiting to see if that money will ever come through from the state. But he's done a good job of doing that. He's been more of a focal point. Last year, he was only in town a few times because of his busy business schedule, but he is planning on being here a lot more this year. So I think people, they see him, and I think it's a little more reassuring for fans that ownership actually cares about the team. So it's been really good since he took over, and he's really fulfilled his promises of being more of a focal point of the team.
Yeah, I see a trend in the Eastern League where some newer owners are becoming the focal point for fans, and I think it's great. You know, Ken Babby up in Akron, Mark Butler in Harrisburg. I think it's a great thing to see some new energetic owners breathe some life into some Eastern League cities.
Well, yeah, that's one thing I noticed whenever I usually try to get to Akron at least once a year. And, you know, there's times where the owner's throwing out T-shirts to fans and he's doing different things. There was a promotion, I think, where he gave $100 to somebody in the stands randomly. So I think that's where Fernando, honestly, I think it's the first place he actually went in the Eastern League after a year to kind of observe things was Akron and talk to Ken Babby a lot. So he's done a great job over at Akron. I really enjoy going to that ballpark. It's really nice, and it's an easy trip for us, so it's really fun to go over there.
And lastly, is there anything you're looking forward to this season in Erie?
Yeah, you know, I'm interested to see how who comes to Erie. There's rumors of a pretty good team coming here early on. You know, last year we had a pretty good team come early in the first few months and got out to a pretty good run to start the season, and then everyone started going away. They were right in the middle of a playoff race, and people were getting promoted and kind of took things away from the Seawolves, and they didn't have a playoff. So hopefully even a good start will result in a pretty good season. The downside is Franklin Perez, number one prospect in the organization, just got injured last week, so he's out 12 weeks right now. So we should see him pitching hopefully by, you know, end of May or something like that, or June. So we'll see where his status is. But the, you know, at the end of the year last year, Erie got a bunch of the prospects that were traded for by the Tigers in that last homestand and the last road trip to Akron. So I'm thinking, you know, this could be a pretty good team this year. We could see some prospects. I'm interested to see where people like Christian Stewart start. I still think he needs to start in Erie this year. I don't think they want him to turn into Steven Moya because Moya was rushed and didn't pan out. So I just think he needs another few months in Double A before he gets going. But, you know, there's rumors of some pretty good pitching coming in to Erie this year. So hopefully it's a pretty good team. And also the rumor of Tim Tebow starting in Binghamton, they'll be here at the end of April. So I think those three games are going to be selling out pretty soon, and people are pretty excited about that. So the Seawolves have pretty good promotions, Tebow possibly coming in, and a pretty good team maybe. So this year could be a pretty exciting year in Erie.
Once again, Tom, thanks so much for your time. Look for him at the Erie Times News for Seawolves coverage. You can find him on Twitter at ETN Reason Weber, and we'll see you on down the road.
All right, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.